Oh, hello there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show peeking over the pop culture we all love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining are digital strategist Winner Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello. Journalist Margaret Wappler.
Hi, Guy.
Hello, Margaret. And academic and DJ Oliver Wang.
How you doing, Guy?
I'm doing all right. I'm sorry that I've, like, failed so hard on last week's episode.
We had a good time.
I feel bad to know that you guys have a good time without me.
Yeah.
What were you doing?
Yes.
It was a horrible, horrible crunch of a day. They're trying to evict me from my apartment in Los Angeles. Aww. And in the course of doing like five different work things and trying to like submit the stuff for that. And this is kind of personal and I shouldn't be talking about it. I just completely forgot to have my my podcasting stuff with me. You guys, every week, let's just segue back into doing the regular show and stop talking about my legal troubles. Every week we start the show by taking a question from a listener about our own pop culture taste. This week, I want you guys to tell me, what's the first piece of media, book, CD, or movie you owned but you tried to hide from your parents? Oliver.
So I was a real goody two-shoes when I was still living at home, and there wasn't anything that I think I ever tried to hide then. To flip the question around, the first piece of media that I found that was hidden from me, me and my cousin were probably about six or seven, and we found my dad's Playboy stash. This was the 70s, so, you know, every dad probably had one. What was fucked up is we got blamed for having it, or we got blamed for finding it and got spanked for it, which to this day just feels incredibly unjust. Like, it wasn't even our shit, and we're being punished for it. Like, what the fuck was that about? So, yeah.
Did you actually get to look at it?
The only thing I remember was that the cover had a woman dressed up as a butterfly, but I don't remember anything from the interior content. I'm sure the articles were amazing.
Oh, of course. Great interviews.
Yes, great interviews.
Margaret, what was the first thing you tried to hide from your parents?
Well, my mother was really into using the TV as a babysitter because that's how people used to do parenting back before helicopter parenting took over. And she would plop me down when I was about 5 years old to watch Sesame Street and Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And what came on right after those shows was Three's Company. And she was supposed to come in there and get me by the time Three's Company came on. But sometimes she'd get distracted or you know, she was in the middle of something and she would be like 10 minutes late walking in there. And I learned pretty early that if I looked like I was watching it, that would be a problem and I'd get yelled at. But if I looked like I was distracted,
great strategy,
and was like coloring or something, she'd be kind of like less anxious about it. So I would just live for catching those first 10 minutes of like Jack Tripper being like a weird perv and like rubbing up against
Chrissy. Did you know what was happening though?
I mean, I didn't. I just knew that it was sexual. I knew that it was like sexual and strange and that I wasn't really supposed to be watching it.
Stuff that feels illicit when you're like seven or eight is always so fascinating.
Yeah, I did. I couldn't have verbalized why it was sexual even, but I just knew that it was.
Did it ever make you want to live in Santa Monica?
Well, at that time I did live in California. Yeah.
Winner, what about you?
Knowing what channel Spice Channel was on, which was set 27, which is such an odd placement because it was like right around C-SPAN and ESPN. It wasn't like in its old section, like now porn is like in its whole own section on cable. So I knew what channel it was on. It was scrambled back then. So basically you could hear it, but you couldn't see it. But you could see it kind of. Like, so there would be some sections where it would just like stutter and like a whole like – looks like an Instagram now of just like movement. And I would, that would just, wow. It was so exciting. I never got, my mom and dad never busted me watching that though.
Your parents should have been more vigilant. That's, it's their job to know about that.
Excuse me, do not judge me. I am a beautiful, blossoming woman even then. And I was looking for some excitement.
For me, it was, there was this fantasy author named Mercedes Lackey who wrote a bunch of novels about magical horses that like bonded with herald mages. It was all very sort of like bad schlocky fantasy that I was just consuming when I was 13 or 14. But then she like started a new series that was like set in the prehistory of this land. And I got them very excited. And when I got home, I started reading about these two adorable guys in their late teens with like very complex hair and magical powers who were deeply drawn to each other. And I like, the thing is, my parents never paid attention to any books that I read, but I like put it on the shelf and was terrified of it and was just terrified that they were in some way going to realize that I was reading what was essentially the forerunner to like anime pretty boy gay stuff. It was pretty terrible and embarrassing.
I want to read this book.
I kind of want to read it too.
It sounds awesome.
I would get like so tense while reading them that I kind of couldn't.
That's the same way I felt watching Spice Channel. You just, it's
yeah,
too
if
much.
You feel tense when you're little reading or watching it, you know it's good stuff.
Thanks to Red Gears in the Reddit for that question. Coming up in this week's show, we're going to talk about our summer reading, the books we're all loving right now. Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events caught our attention this week. Margaret, what are you into this week?
Well, I had a great holiday weekend of taking in two really strong music movies. The first one was Love and Mercy about Brian Wilson. And I'll just say right off the bat that Paul Dano... We talked about this a few weeks ago. There's a question about like who would you go and see if they're attached to a movie? And he's becoming that actor for me where he is just amazing and channels young Brian Wilson in this way that is not showy, really authentic, really manages to capture a certain kind of like fragility in Brian Wilson without it being hammy. Or seeming like a put-upon thing. In the movie, it jumps around in time so that the older Brian Wilson is played by John Cusack, who is also really strong, but it's just not quite the same caliber performance. And then there's Paul Giamatti, who plays Eugene Landy, who's this psychiatrist who basically tried to completely bamboozle Brian Wilson out of all sorts of... legal rights and over-medicated him, told him he was a paranoid schizophrenic when he actually has a different diagnosis. And it's a really fascinating story. And I found the music scenes in the movie really compelling, really well done. And the other movie that I saw, and the one connection between these two movies is that both of the main characters in the movie suffer from mental illness and it really ravaged their life. The other movie that I saw is What Happened, Miss Simone, which is this great documentary on Netflix right now about Nina Simone.
I watched it on like Saturday. The interplay between politics and mental illness in her life is so fascinating. Her being both sort of like the jazz artist, the black artist who most completely gave herself to the struggle and being somebody who was just overcome with schizophrenia? No, manic depression, right?
She was
bipolar. Yeah, it was fascinating.
Yeah, it was a really well-done documentary, and I think it really managed to capture this incredibly complex relationship she had with violence. You know, really being enamored by violence in a lot of ways and wanting violence to be part of the civil rights movement on a certain level, and then also being a victim of domestic abuse and then turning around and doing that to her daughter as well. And it's just she has such an elaborate... labyrinthine kind of relationship with it that it would be impossible to parse it out, but it's fascinating to see sort of all the different ways in which it enacts in her music. You know, there's this anger, there's this power, there's also this beauty. You know, she has this great quote in the movie about, you know, she's just simply singing what she feels, and sometimes she's going to sound like gravel and then other times she's going to sound like coffee and cream.
It's the best.
One of the things I was reading, I haven't seen the Simone documentary yet, but one of the reviews I read about it felt that it was strange that they would interview her, I guess her ex-husband, who beat her, and that in what other circumstances would you normally see that? Like if you had a biopic or a documentary about Tina Turner, would you have Ike on there? I mean, he's dead now, so that'd be really hard, but you know what I'm saying. Did that strike you as strange?
No, it didn't. I thought it was a good decision. They actually didn't interview him. They use old footage of the daughter interviewing him, which is interesting because he has sort of a different attitude than I think he would have if it was a regular documentarian interviewing him, where there's a little more intimacy in the interview. But, you know, he was a manager for her for a long time and pretty instrumental in getting her a lot of her successes rolling. And I think that's an interesting corollary with Ike Turner, too, that, you know, he was this abusive figure who also factored heavily into her success. Mm-hmm. So it's a complicated story, but it's also the movie. It does a good job of making it a family story. Like Lisa Simone, her daughter, is a huge, you know, backbone to the story.
Well, not having sort of the tidy simplicity of Ike and Tina, but turning around and saying he beat the shit out of Nina and then Nina turned around and beat the shit out of Lisa.
Yeah.
Like that was very raw.
Very raw. Yeah.
Can I ask a quick question about Love and Mercy?
Sure.
Is it one of those films like Julie and Julia where you really just want to watch half the movie and you wish they would edit out the other half?
You know, not for me, but I've definitely read some comments from people feeling like John Cusack, for one thing, distractingly does not look like Brian Wilson, where Paul Dano does. You know, Paul Dano even just has this hair and just his face. But, you know, that didn't bother me. But I'm also a John Cusack fan. Like, I like him. And I liked the way those two pieces, I like the interlocking between the older Brian Wilson and the younger one.
Winner, what are you all about this week?
LA Times hired a black Twitter reporter. That's what he's being considered to be. But he's actually covering like a lot of things having to do with culture. I'm trying to find his name in my phone. Dexter Thomas, who is on Twitter. He has another name on Twitter, which we can totally put on the Facebook page. And everybody probably already knows. But he's going to cover Black Medium, Latino Tumblr, and Line in Japan, which is like a micro messaging service. But I just think it's an interesting hire. I think it's a great hire. It's a great hire.
Yeah.
Black Twitter is this community that's just wide and vast, and they really find an opportunity to sort of expound their thoughts and ideals and position on any topic. They can make any topic into like this whole just conversation that will at a certain point starts trending on Twitter. And I think it's going to be really interesting to have somebody look at it sociologically, like to go into the community and find out sort of who's the influencer there, look at Latino Tumblr, which is not something that I would actually be looking at, but I'm interested to see what he uncovers there. And he has a really good background in history, like where he's worked in college radio and did social media there. And he's got like this whole resume that seems perfect for it. And I know Oliver mentioned earlier that there were people who were saying maybe he's not the best person. But the thing is like this guy should not be reporting on this was the top five memes of the day and this is the best memes about picnics and watermelon. Like he should be able to sort of uncover what it has transitioned into. The whole movement with everything that's been happening, Black Lives Matter, that's a whole subset. There's the community in Africa. There's a huge social media contingent in Nigeria because now they have phones now because they're actually able to have phones before computers. There's a whole movement happening with, you know, diversity on social media. So I think it's really
also
smart.
To the point of there are people saying that he's not the best person for the job, we live in an age when for any hire, any public hire, people are going to be able to write an essay about how they're not the best person.
Why are people saying that about him? I mean, he's not even done the job yet. How can people say he's not the best hire?
I mean, one of the critiques I saw were that, you know, he hasn't spent enough time posting on Black Twitter itself.
I actually think that's better that he hasn't.
He's really into East Asian culture, and therefore he doesn't seem black enough. I mean, that's the gist of it.
Right.
Which is,
I wouldn't seem black enough to participate in Black Twitter, but at the same time, I can be a casual observer and still be a participant.
Yeah, you don't want somebody who's super, super inside so that they don't have any kind of distance.
They have to be objective.
Oliver, what's up?
So just to get this straight, he's basically covering multiracial social media. So he's got Black Twitter, Latino Tumblr, which I'm assuming refers primarily to Latino American people who are using Tumblr. And then what was the last one?
No, as for Tumblr, I think that goes beyond that, just America. And then the last one is Line in Japan, which is a micro messaging service that is one of their main forms of interacting with each other via their phones. So
does that mean he's basically skipping over Asians in America and just going straight to like the OG source?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know what he's
doing. I'm sure he'll get
in
there too.
He'll get in there too.
Americans.
We don't know enough, to be honest, about what Asian social media services are out there. We only hear about them when they get here, and we utilize them the way we utilize them in America. There's a the community there, from what I know, just with the Weibos and
WeChat and China,
WeChat and all that other stuff. Like, it's very, very advanced, and it's and they use it for a lot more things than just what we do here, which is to avoid people that we're dating and get directions and confirm them. Really, it's really the truth.
I know, but I'm just wondering, like, where does my community fit into sort of this coverage?
You need to write him a letter and
ask him, give him some suggestions.
Give him a tweet. Tweet at him.
Oliver, you get to be honorary white the way that you've always been in Silicon Valley. as long as you're chill and you don't bother us. That was a joke.
Ouch.
Okay, this week I have two little things that I'm all about. The first one is I saw Magic Mike. And
I'm so excited to see it.
Oh, Margaret, it's amazing. It's a revelation. I don't know if it's a story, but I've never seen anything that took like larger women's sexuality so seriously. And like, there are way more Black women in this. It's really interesting. Also, I would like to say we need to propose to Alison Bechdel that there is an exception to the Bechdel test where it either has to be two women talking about something other than a man, or Jada Pinkett Smith in a fedora asking a bunch of women if they're ready for some grown woman shit.
Oh, I like that. Mm.
It's the best. And the other thing is, I was searching around on the internet, as I do. I was Canada Day, and I wanted to watch stuff from the CBC, and none of it was available here. But then I found something with an extremely intriguing name, The Book of Negroes.
Oh, wow.
And I looked it up, and it's essentially Canada and BET got together to make Canadian Roots.
Mm-hmm.
And I bought it on Amazon, and it's real, real good.
How does it measure against the American Roots?
Well, I had just watched Roots, and it's told from a woman's perspective. It's similar in that it starts out with 2 hours in Africa, and then her like going through slavery, then siding with the British during the Revolutionary War, and because of that, getting to go up to Nova Scotia as a free woman after the war. What's most amazing about it is CBC and BET are both notorious for making real, real janky television.
Yes.
And it looks really, really good. It's so, with the exception of Cuba Gooding Jr. doing an accent that no one could understand.
Oh, he's in it. You lost me.
Oh.
No,
oh,
but ouch. Like there are some really amazing performances in it, and it's just, it's the kind of iconic story that doesn't get told from a woman's perspective. Mm-hmm. And that was amazing. And then also, it's just, it was fun to watch something that just had a different and undeniably Canadian perspective on the Revolutionary War, where redcoats showing up are the thing that saves you. It's a really good watch if you're into that kind of thing, which we all know I am. you should check it out. And Oliver, what are you all about this week?
So originally I was going to talk about True Detective season 2, but that certainly can wait till next week when hopefully the show will get better. I think, you know, as a squad, I feel like we are obligated to talk about Rihanna's "Bitch Better Have My Money" video, which is just the latest in a line of explosively controversial videos that have come out during the course of the year. But this one really seems to have inspired a gazillion hot takes on it and, you know, of both defending the video or chastising it. You know, for those who haven't seen it yet, Rihanna takes her song lyrics at the most literal, where, you know, "I have your wife in the back of my car" is not some kind of sexual taunt. It's actually literally, "I have your wife tied up because I've kidnapped her, and you know, I'm going to torture her until you give me my money back because she's mad at her accountant," something like that. So the controversy happens to be that it's a white woman being tied up and being subjected to sexualized violence, and then there's a lot of blood involved. The last scene, this is not a huge spoiler, the last scene is Rihanna sitting in a trunk of money, naked, covered in blood, which is just an amazing image. I mean, whoever directed or shot the video, there's remarkable just visual stuff going on there. But it sort of inspired, to me, this really completely tiring old debate around, is this feminist or not, which I feel like is the question that if you have to ask that, the conversation's already lost in essence. Anytime you have to ask, is this feminist or not, then you've already gotten things off to the wrong start. Now, Guy,
I don't know. As the only woman on this panel, I think it's my place to say, I feel like we're in a situation of we're still figuring out what feminism should be in a world of colonized minds and bodies. Figuring out what you want is always hard, and figuring out the best ways of approaching it is hard. And so I do think that debate is going to take place.
Well, Guy, you actually literally just watched the video before we started taping. So what did you think?
I thought, wow. I thought, wow, this is a lot of violence being thrown at that conventional concept of what a woman should be. I liked the compatriots she had in the car. I thought that it sent an interesting message. And also the aesthetic of the way they were being ballers was so interestingly subversive that it was really compelling to me. I like a nice shit show.
Well, okay. Winner's so looking you can, at me.
No,
Winner
because
wants me to, okay.
The reason why I want you to go is because you're going to be able to frame it up in the most intelligent way possible because you're so well read, and then I'm gonna back it up and get ratchet. So you go. That's how we play this together. Okay,
just so you know. Good cop, bad cop.
Yeah, good.
Right,
so
here.
She's in a good cop it right now.
Okay, so I watched the video, and I'll say this: that I was waiting to be shocked, and I never was. I just never was shocked.
It's not that shocking.
It's not that shocking. I feel like this is all in the Tarantino '90s mm-hmm. like violent movie mode. And, I'm mixed about the video. There's some things I really love about it. Like, I think it's shot beautifully. The DP from Spring Breakers apparently was the person on this. So, yeah, exactly. And I think that shot, for instance, of the woman underneath the water in the pool was beautiful.
Yeah.
The shot of her in the trunk was amazing. So there are lots of moments I love out of it. But I have to say that I just feel like if you want to make a revenge video, torture the man, not the woman. Torture the man. Because I've seen women getting tortured all the time. And okay, here's the other point. If it's going to be a revenge fantasy about torturing white women, then leave the man out of it. Like, make it clear what your point is, because I feel like she wants to have it every which way, which to me is sort of like not a very courageous artistic statement. So I just feel like it was kind of Rihanna being like, these are a bunch of cool controversial images. I kind of don't care how they play. And I want her to just have a little more like statement. Like, tell me what you really think.
She's never really done that. And I know why, because I don't really think that she can eloquently say that.
Yeah.
She smokes weed all day long. However, she's like so important to like whatever is happening right now in Black America, because Black kids, Black people who listen to her music it's not like we're just walking around with our race card like prominently displayed. We're just looking for somebody to say something mm-hmm. that they can't, because of the money or whatever, endorsements, can't really say. This felt like that. There's a lot of that happening on Twitter, especially with Black women being perceived as a threat to white women. So she sort of just, especially with the feminist, there's the Black feminist and white feminist movement. So it was just like her just kind of saying, fuck it all. Also, the song's really tight. Like, the song I didn't really care that much about beforehand. But then when you tied it in with the visuals, it was basically how I was stimulated in the 80s. I needed the video, then I needed the song. Then it was like, over, I'm like adoring you. So I really like the song. But I also, there's like so many parts of it that are fucking hilarious.
It's true. I mean, her whole band of friends, amazing.
When she beats, I made a gift for myself, just for me, of the girl busting the bottle over the girl's head. Because that's like, bitch, shut up. Like, it can be used in any reference. I don't really need her to make too many statements, but I feel like this is like a little bit of a subtweet saying like, bitch, I see you and I'm sick of it too. I don't know. That's just kind of where I went with it. I just really enjoyed it. I wasn't shocked, though. Don't even get me wrong. I was not shocked.
I also feel like it is not uncommon for people who are really, really interesting visual thinkers mm-hmm. to not be able to hone a cleanly articulable sort of perspective,
Yes. Yeah.
Like, the sort of people who are making a video of this of what's awesome, what's awesome. and like are like touching on and grabbing at social issues, but maybe, you know, like not essay writers. Like Gus Van Sant always kills me with his, like, that was gorgeous. What the fuck were you trying to say?
She's really like, and the person, and the girl who helped her do the design is my friend Ciara. And Ciara's worked with Rihanna since the very beginning. Mm. She was like her A&R rep. It's always important. I really, really believe this. When you have a group of people that will help you mine things, that'll help you make that difference. She found the girl who's in the video, the one that the heavier brown haired girl, the brunette. She found her on Instagram. She followed her and then, like, reached out to her and started talking to her. And I think that's really – that's just so cool. Like, you are being inspired by this girl who lives in Seattle and works at, like, a bookstore or a fruit market. Mm. I mean, though, you change people's lives when you have that much influence.
I don't want to deal with quirky Instagram famous. I just want regular hot Instagram famous and that guy who is famous for his man bun. Oliver, I know that we need to wrap up, but this is also your topic. Do you have any further thoughts on the video?
I watched this video the same week I watched Kendrick Lamar's video for All Right, which is also phenomenal,
amazing.
And visually stunning. And it's interesting because, you know, Rihanna, the subtext supposedly is that it's all about kind of, you know, this black vengeance against white people, and All Right is about, you know, there's multiple depictions of white police officers shooting black people. And so these two videos, whether they mean to or not, are sort of in conversation with one another. I'm supposed to come up with something clever and insightful to say about it. I mean, for one thing, I really just am exhausted at the fast pace of how many takes come out about anything that is remotely racially controversial at this point. We're not allowed to sit with anything long enough to really think through anything. In a lot of ways,
the sheer number of essays about how racist Amy Schumer is.
Yeah.
Like,
oh my God.
It's like, you know, we can talk about this shit, but when you're getting 9 of them in a week, it's just so much.
Like 9 of them in a 24-hour cycle, you know? That's why I liked, you know, one of our Facebook group people posted that great essay by Helen Lewis. And the thing that I liked about it, whether you disagree or agree with the article in New Statesman, she had this tone that was like, here I am firing up the hot take machine. And I know that feeling so well as a person who's had to attack things many times as a hot taker, where you're just like, oh, God. Like, you just get tired of being outraged or being whatever it is or whatever it requires of you at that moment.
And that's why you need a Black Twitter Times reporter.
Yes.
I mean, we're probably just contributing to this same phenomenon. So we're part of the problem that we're also
naming.
It
always is like that, though.
But
we can all agree that the popular rage against P. Guacamole was fine, though, right?
Yes. That was totally acceptable. I don't think we're outraged enough. Bring down that P. Guacamole flag.
I need to try it. I'm keeping an open mind.
Bring it down.
So I will try to close this out on one comment here, which is that I do think it's fascinating to me as someone who – growing up, I didn't really think that race in the way that it is now was always at the forefront of the conversation, to the point where people can complain about being exhausted by that. That just wasn't part of what people were saying, you know, in the 90s in terms of, oh, I'm tired of talking about race. I'm sure you could find instances of that. I do feel like right now the fact that artists are continually – and this has really only happened, I'd say, in the last year or two at most, but they've continually pushed that button over and over and over again. I think that's good. Like, we should be making people feel awkward and uncomfortable and pissed off, because that way you can never be complacent about not having to think about this all the time. So if that's what Rihanna's helping to do, if that's what Kendrick Lamar is helping to do, whoever else, hey, I'm all for that.
Oliver, I'm pretty sure that race is your and Winter's problem. Margaret and I are fine.
Wait, hold on. Really fast. I can't even say anything more about it, but I like what Oliver said, and I saw Straight Outta Compton.
Oh, how is it?
Oh.
Please tell me it's okay.
Dude, it's basically A Hard Day's Night meets Boys in the Hood.
That sounds amazing.
Yeah. And it was 2.5 hours long, and I can't say much more about it because Universal will probably cut my dick off in less than 12 minutes. But
I thought your dick already was cut off.
I don't have a dick. I'm sorry, guys. I just ruined everything. I have a vagina.
More about Winter's boating accident after this. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back.
I'm sorry. Boating accident. I love it.
Hi, I'm Katie from Philadelphia, and I listen to Bullseye because it is carefully curated to give me new things I should be listening to, old things I should definitely have been watching, and new perspectives on why I like the stuff that I like.
I'm Jesse Thorne. I'll talk to actress Judy Greer and musician Ishmael Butler on the next Bullseye from NPR.
All right, welcome back to Pop Rocket. I'm your host, Guy Branum. Over in the studio in Los Angeles are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
You guys, I don't know if you noticed, but it is summertime. we are all going to the beach more and picnicking and being by pools. And of course, we all need to win pizza parties for our fourth grade class. So we've all been doing a lot of summer reading. And we just wanted to talk about, like, the aesthetics of a good summer reading book, what you're looking for. Margaret, you write about books a lot. What to you is the platonic ideal of a summer book?
Well, I think the platonic ideal that most people are familiar with is the summer read being maybe just a little bit trashier than you might read during the rest of the year, that it's definitely something that you can just sink your teeth into. It's a page turner. You can read it on the beach and maybe want to cover it up with a towel because it's slightly embarrassing. But, you know, I was thinking about my own version of the summer read, and I think, you know, some of those hold true for me too, but I pretty much stay the same for summer reads. In fact, I want to steal this friend of mine's line where she says that, you know, there are summer reads for those of us who just wear jeans to the beach.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm a little bit in that category where it's basically still the same literature that I'm reading all year around, except that I will probably during the summer go for things that are a little more voicey, that are a little more like catch you on the first page and aren't so challenging where you're like, I got to get through the first 50 before I
what do you
what
mean by
about.
Like voicey?
Like a character who you really relate to and that has a really just catchy voice where you're like, I want to listen to this person tell me about the world.
For me, there's an element of soapy bullshit that I will allow myself to read during the summertime. And I'd never really thought about it before, but are you familiar with the book Corelli's Mandolin?
Oh, yeah.
Captain Corelli's Mandolin?
Yeah, was that
it? The movie was called Captain Corelli's Mandolin, but it was basically like this sweeping war-torn saga and a romance and like all of that stuff, which if it had like good writing underneath it, like it's The English Patient without being good or complex, you know? And I just like that's the sort of thing that is like just great to like soak up during a summertime. I'm also like this is the official time of year for like books of like funny essays, like everything that all of my friends on Chelsea Lately wrote about motherhood, like all
yes.
of those books. This is the appropriate time. My friend Isaac Oliver, he's a gay writer here in New York who like reads stories a lot, but he just published a book called Intimacy Idiot that is basically just accounts of like Grindr hookups and various hookups.
Oh, that sounds great.
It's really, really funny. It's just so funny. And also, there's something about self-contained chapters that makes it easy to sort of, like, sun yourself and flip through something and then put it down and focus on the mishigas going on in the pool.
Yeah, I think in a way, summer reads are like anything that you saw Carmela Soprano reading on The Sopranos. Like, yeah. I love that she reads Memoirs of a Geisha, and I feel like that's, like, where you can go during the summer read.
Memoirs of a Geisha is perfect. Winter, what are your summer reads?
I was telling the guys this earlier, but I haven't read a book in the summertime in a really long time. I spent a lot of my growing up reading during the summer because I hated going outside and interacting with other kids. So
also got to get those pizza parties.
Well, exactly. I was trying to win that shit. I really was doing the Lord's work for all of them. But then recently, the only book that I picked up, because I really do read a lot over just in general, but I wanted to read something kind of like trashy. Mm-hmm. So I started reading I'll Take Manhattan because it was my favorite miniseries growing up with my great grandmother had read the book and loved the miniseries. So I'll Take Manhattan is I just bought it on it was like 99 cents on
who
the bookstore
wrote it?
On iTunes. Huh?
Who wrote it? Is that like Jackie
Judith
Collins
Krantz,
or something?
Judith Krantz.
Okay, yes.
And it's about this this huge Manhattan, really, really uber-rich family. And Valerie Bertinelli was in the movie, which she was did a tour de force performance. But the family has just, like, layers. They're from England. They're from Canada. They've got, like, money. And then basically the, like, 20-year-old ends up inheriting everything. So it's all about her taking over Manhattan.
2 years ago, during the summer, I read Sex and the City, like the original.
Oh, really?
I never
How
read that.
Tough of a read is that?
It's terrible.
Yes, it's so bad.
So not good. Like, it really is. You know that book about the Upper East Side ladies who get their spousal bonuses?
Right.
First of all, that seems like a really good summer read.
Yeah.
But it was basically that just written by an insider with no children.
Right.
Like, it was just, yeah, there are only 40 men in Manhattan I can date. It's like, fuck you, lady.
Get a life.
How did such an amazing TV show
come and from the source material?
Yes, exactly. Oliver.
So I was a real binge reader as a kid. So on summer vacations, I would go to the library and basically get a book a day and tear through it. And at that time, I was reading a lot of fantasy. I think one of my favorite authors was David Eddings. And I'm sure if I went back to his books, they probably wouldn't hold up at all.
Oh, Margaret and Winter, you guys can leave the booth now.
Yeah, educate us because I don't know who this is.
Okay, imagine Lord of the Rings, but without the PhD in, like, ancient Anglo-Saxon studies. Like, it was but so satisfying. Oliver, tell them about these books.
No, I mean, Eddings, yeah. I mean, like many fantasy writers who were post-Tolkien, it was an attempt at doing some of the world-building and the sorcery and all this shit that went into Tolkien, but minus sort of, you know, 13 pages of descriptions of what hobbits eat, something like that. and you know, again, I have not read any of these novels in, I don't know, probably 20 years. I loved them at the time because—
Were they a series?
Yeah. And he wrote, I think, a total of at least four different three to five book series. So he was basically a series guy.
No, they were all five books. Maybe some of them were three. I'm sorry. The Belgariad, the Malorian,
yes.
And then two other things.
I love that guy knows this. This is fantastic. they were well-written fantasy books that were aimed at a— probably, you know, I was around 20-something at the time, so I was probably right in that peak, you know, age group. Because, again, it wasn't asking too much from you in the way that Tolkien, or I guess maybe George Martin does today. Ooh. It wasn't sort of crazy dumbing it down either. It sort of hit that sweet spot. Really familiar narratives, but funny characters. And I think the thing that stood out to me about Eddings was just the level of humor that he brought into it.
There was a lot of sass. Like, there were a lot of ladies who were really getting— Polgara was very attitude-y, and then there was that lady who killed the guys with a Garrett. She was always sassing people.
You're killing people with a Garrett. You got to be sassy.
But I was going to say my favorite summer read, because I come back to this often, is actually Tom Clancy's Executive Decisions, which is probably not— – I mean, it's certainly not one of his best-known novels. But to me, it's perhaps his most ambitious of the kind of Jack Ryan series. And it opens, and I think the reason why it's never been made into a film, besides the fact that it's sprawling and be really difficult, is that it opens in the aftermath of someone having crashed a commercial airliner into Congress during the joint meeting of the houses. Of course, this is all pre-9/11. In fact, after 9/11, Clancy got interviewed on CNN, I think, only because he had written this scene into a book, and suddenly that made him an expert on terrorism involving commercial airliners. But the basic gist of it is the U.S. government has been completely crippled because most of all of our politicians are now dead. Jack Ryan was the vice president. He becomes president. And he has to figure out how to both reconstruct the federal government from the ground up as well as fend off a Ebola biological attack by the joint Iranian-Iraqi government that has now been formed. And I just thought – I mean to this day, it is still an amazing page-turner. And there are a lot of problems with Clancy across the board in terms of his politics and the fact that he gets way too into kind of descriptions of how military, you know, technological systems work. But to me, in terms of just as a narrative, I love this book. It has great set pieces. It has great scenes. And for a book that is probably a good, I don't know, 800 pages or so, to me, I can go back to it every summer and still read it from cover to cover and feel satisfied, you know, in terms of the kind of narrative payoff in it.
Is he like Michael Crichton, where he's actually informed environmental policy? Because you guys know how Bush, like, talked to Michael Crichton about the environment and used that to set policy during his presidency?
I wouldn't be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, Clancy was huge with a particular kind of 80s and 90s generation of the Republican readers and thinkers.
I find that kind of crossover amazing.
The really glorious baby boomer white guys of genre fiction are – because, like, it's easy to look down on Tom Clancy or John Grisham or Michael Crichton, and then you read one of those books and you kind of, like, are like, yeah, this is a book for airports.
Oh, yeah. But they're just so tightly constructed. It's amazing. Yeah.
Well, my friend Carolyn Kepnes wrote a book that Stephen King called the scariest book he'd ever read, and it's called You. And if – that seems like an aggressive read, Oliver, for the Ebola book. But it's if something that you can sort of fade into summer with. Do people really usually read books that are just like kind of like, oh, I need a boyfriend. Oh, I found one. Oh, he's not the one. Like, you know, those type of summer books.
I think Bridget Jones's Diary was like one of the biggest summer books ever. Yeah, I think that's absolutely.
That whole market is just, it's just fascinating to me because if it's summer and I'm slowing down, I want to get into something that I can really, that can take like a bite out of. Mm. I find it with all the available time to read and think and consume, I feel like it's insulting that we're pushed these books that are just, you know, kind
fluffy.
You know what I mean? I want meatier.
There was a period of time when I was like going on a lot of meetings to like adapt things. And I had to read a lot of really, really bad YA novels. Everyone was buying every YA novel. And I get kind of mad at the way that these like 200 page books that don't really even finish a story have kind of occupied the space where stuff like Jennifer Weiner novels or like, you know, some of that stuff that was like more thoughtful and interesting, but was still, you know, something like The Nanny Diaries or The Devil Wears Prada, which like is at least an adult book.
Yeah, it's strange that YA has taken over to some extent as a beach read or just even as a read for women. And I think it has to do with a certain kind of tone that is more prevalent in YA than adult books, mm-hmm. which is this real sort of like joy of discovery. Mm-hmm. Like the first time you have a crush, the first time you kiss someone, the first time you go away to college.
The first time you get cancer.
All of those things are played up. Yeah, first time you get cancer. All of those things are played up in the YA scope. And I think that's really attractive to women readers for reasons that I think are, you know, worth investigating for sure.
So real quick, what are we all reading right now? Guy?
I'm reading Wonderland by Stacey DeRassimo, which is about like a rock star in her 40s who's like trying to get her career going again. And she's just an author who I like mainly from the critical work of hers that I have read. And then I saw that she had a book and I was like, I will read that. That seems like fun.
Yeah, I'm excited to read that. I really want to read that. That and the Judy Blume book.
Oh, yeah.
Title?
In an unlikely event.
Are you reading it?
Event.
No, I'm are not you? Reading anything. I don't have time to read. I have 9 clients. I read Medium. Were you asking me or were you asking Margaret?
No, I was asking you because then I have another question about your reading after this. But Margaret, or what are you reading right now?
Well, I'm reading a book called A Planet for Rent, which is by this Cuban science fiction author called Voss. It just got this big blow-up review in the New York Times. But then I met the publisher of this book at a party in New York, and he kind of sold me on this book in person. And it's really amazing so far. It's basically Earth after it's been racked by all these economic and environmental problems. And it
so
gets
like, so like now, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. And it gets colonized by aliens. Aliens come in and basically turn it into a giant tourist destination.
That's amazing.
It's amazing. And it's of course, tight. It has this great corollary between, like, America and Cuba. You know, like, Cuba being ravaged by various problems there. And America, we are all just salivating at the idea that we can flood in there as tourists and really have no other real interest in it. And the author is very interesting, too. I mean, he's quite well-known. In Cuba. He also is like a heavy metal guy. Like, it's just a fascinating read so far.
Oliver, what about you?
I just started reading Scarface's memoir. This is Scarface from Ghetto Boys, Brad Johnson. And the book is called Diary of a Madman. And it's basically about his career with the Ghetto Boys and how he came up and, you know, growing up in South Houston. And it's a really great read. I mean, Scarface to me is one of the most thoughtful and insightful rappers out there, and one of the few cases of someone who blew up in the, you know, late 80s and early 90s and still is very much a relevant part of music today. You know, me being me, the main takeaway that I've gotten out of the first maybe third of the book is that Scarface's first release, it was a single back when he was called DJ Action, was unintentionally released on 45 because his label guy had no idea what he was doing. And Scarface basically barked on him and said, how's it going to look that I'm going to put a 45 out there? I guess it wasn't manly enough, unlike a 12-inch, which is just bigger. But for me, I'm just thinking, I really need to find that 45 now.
All right. I have one more question, maybe two. First one is basically like pools, beaches. Where is your preferred place to do your summer reading? And then second part of that is basically, what is your flipping mind fodder? Like, what magazines, what bullshit will you have at a pool or on the beach along with your summer read? Margaret.
Well, I always will have, like, a great novel and then, like, an issue of Vanity Fair because I need to know how rich people got murdered this month. So I'll just toggle between those. Like, last summer, I was on the beach and I read Ruth Ozeki's A Tale for the Time Being, which is a great, amazing summer read, I think. You just really sink into the story. It's slightly surreal. It involves like the relationship between Japan, China, and the U.S. So that was a great summer read for me last year in particular that I'd recommend. And I think when I just got sort of burnt out of like reading one continuous story, then I would just pick up Vanity Fair and see like how like a beautiful woman was murdered.
But you do love The Sun in a Chaise Lounge.
Oh, yeah, I do. I like taking in sun. Yeah. It's kind of a problem sometimes because I don't put on sunscreen.
Dude,
until
what
later.
Are you doing?
I know.
Winter, pool fan, beach fan?
I like the. This is so snobby. I don't like going to the beach in California, okay? I just don't care about California beaches. They're dirty. We don't take care of them. They're nasty.
What about a nice Malibu private
beach?
I've been there, but I still don't care about California beaches. Too many things wash up dead. I do really in anything, right? If I go to the beach, like in Mexico or the Caribbean or Hawaii, which are my favorite places, or Italy.
Only Italy
okay.
For
Italy.
Me.
Okay.
I read only Italy for
Amalfi
me.
Amalfi Coast or where are we talking?
I sound so obnoxious.
Only Italian Vogue.
Well, no, I like to read. You asked me if I had any summer reads. I don't. Okay. Sorry. But I do read The Hollywood Reporter. I read Us in less than 5 minutes because I work there and I know how to read it.
You have
future,
to tell us that
yeah,
guy.
Yeah, future episode, Winter's Guide to Reading Us in 5 minutes.
And then, you know, THR, Variety, Vogue. I have a subscription to Vogue and that's it. Everything else I read online. I just can't not read online. I read Medium. I read Brain Pickings.
But
I read
all of that stuff is That's all work stuff for you. There's never like a Mary Claire just for you.
No, there really isn't, because you know what? I spend my entire life reading. I've read so much. The one thing that I do regret not reading more of, because I didn't go to college really, is I didn't get into the classics. So I have made a commitment to myself that I will read the classics before I'm 40, just so I can have something to talk about when I'm at those singles meetings.
Better get cracking.
Better get cracking.
Oliver, what about you? Are you a beach fan?
I do not like reading near bodies of water because I just fear that I'm going to drop my book into wherever.
Are you reading in a wading pool? What? Are you in a sauna?
No, what kind of Californians are you?
Actually, yeah, I know. I don't like reading outdoors. Partly, I don't like reading outdoors. I like reading inside of some kind of interior space. Probably the place where I like reading the most is on the metro. And as someone who rides the metro a lot.
Do you have a reading pose, Oliver?
A reading pose?
I really don't have
one. No one asked you about that, Oliver.
Oh, I'm sorry. I did just choose.
What I asked you is, do you like the beach? Do you like pools?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought this was about the reading part of it.
We'll get to that.
I like both, but if I had to choose between the two, probably pools. I grew up around pools more, so
that's understandable. And like, what is your primary flipping magazine? I understand that you are a heterosexual cisgendered man, so you're going to spend less time getting pedicures than the rest of us.
But, he likes Popular Mechanics. Okay,
get off his ass.
Did you just listen to him talk about Tom Clancy for 5 minutes?
I was a big fan of Entertainment Weekly. I had a subscription to it for about a good 10 years. And then I just stopped reading it, not in any conscious way. I think once Grantland.com came out, it replaced my need to get pop culture information from any other place.
And it fell off.
Did it? I don't know if the magazine got worse. I just stopped reading it because
they used to be on the pulse of everything. They would talk about so much amazing shit back in the early 90s. It was a great, great magazine.
I'll say this much. I would not have learned about The Room if not for EW. So that alone makes me glad I had that subscription for 10 years.
Can I please plug two good friends' books, please? Because they are wonderful people. California by Eden Lapucky, who is also my boss woman at my teaching job.
Oh, I heard that's
great. It's great. And the paperback version of that book is going to be out. It's out now. And then the other great book is Kitchens of the Great Midwest, which is by Ryan Stradel. And it's already getting glowing reviews, and it's going to be out this month. And it's really great for foodies in particular, because it's all about a woman who makes a rise as a chef.
A nice book that manages to integrate lots of recipes, your water for chocolate, your heartburn, always a big fan. Mm-hmm. All right, you guys, you're listening to Pop Rocket. We'll be right back after this.
Welcome to Oh No, Ross and Carrie.
Ross.
Hi, Carrie.
What do you think is creepier?
Okay.
You jump into a swimming pool. All of a sudden, the water goes away, and instead of water, there is the bones of your dead ancestors.
Ew.
Or our show.
That's pretty tough, because we've visited a live exorcism.
We joined the Ordo Templi Orientis, where we had to worship a naked lady.
Oh, and we joined that Tony Alamo cult. No. They were scary.
Super creepy. We joined the Aetheri Society.
We tried penis enlargement, or at least I did.
Oh boy, I tried breast enlargement. We have basically done every creepy, weird, fringe thing, except for thousands more, which we will get to if you listen to our show.
I'd still say the swimming pool with my ancestors' bones.
Well, then I don't even know if people should listen.
I guess they shouldn't.
But if you want to, we're at Maximum Fun, and the show's called Ono, Ross, and Carrie.
Welcome back to Pop Rockin'. I'm your host, Guy Branum, in New York, in my apartment, in Bushwick, and over in the studio in Los Angeles are...
Winter Mitchell.
Margaret Wappler.
Oliver Wang.
And every week on Pop Rocket, we ask the age-old question, what's your current jam? Oliver Wang, what is your jam?
We were just talking about beach versus pool, and I think an album that might fit into any of those spaces will be the new album by The Internet. Oh, shit, what the hell is the name of the album? I'm sorry. I have the song. Ego Death. Right, let me try this again. We were just talking about beach versus pool, and I think a new album, a new LA album, as it were, that would fit in quite beautifully in Either Space is the third album by The Internet called Ego Death. And I pulled a song called Gabby featuring Janelle Monáe.
Lately when I look into your eyes, I see indefinite trouble. Darling, as much as I love to try,
so I'm not trying to damn with faint praise here, but the thing that I like best about The Internet, and The Internet is Sid the Kid along with Matt Martians, is just their ability to craft a mood on each of their albums. And I think that their songwriting is decent, but really, to me, it's the album as a whole and just kind of that oral experience you get listening to it is what really wins them over every time. And Ego Death, I think, is very consistent in the same way that their last album, Feel Good, was. It is very much like this rooftop pool party vibe, which normally I would say would be very annoying just picturing what that rooftop party would look like. But it's just the perfect kind of top of the summer. It's super hot. You want something cool to listen to balance things out. And Ego Death really, I think, strikes that kind of nice, comfortable, cool zone for me. And I'm really glad to see them back in the game after I think this is their first album in maybe 2 years now.
Winner, what's your jam this week?
Mine is called Too Young by Post Malone. I discovered this over the weekend on Other Tone, which is, I posted about it in the group. It's a really cool radio show on Beats One, which launched last week on Apple Music. It's their radio station. And it's Scott Viener, who's the music supervisor for Entourage, your favorite show.
The music was probably the best part of
Entourage. The music was the best part of Entourage, let's be honest. that narrative thread was so strong. But, you know, the other thing about him is that he's always been sort of on just like the cutting edge of music discovery online. So he has the Spotify account that was always curated, your favorite word, Oliver. And
crafted
playlist.
Artisanal
playlist. So their radio show was really good, and they had Cara Delevingne and Justin Timberlake on. They played about an hour and a half's worth of music. I discovered this song. I've heard of this guy. He has a song called White Iverson, but there's not much to be known about him. He's a white rapper, and he sounds really super soulful, and it's cool. It's a good song. It's called Too Young by Post Malone.
Came up, don't know, I just keep going with the flow. I just wanna go, call me some, I hit fast, go shopping though. She just wanna hit that bathroom, hold that guard like a register. Keep it when I need that guap a door, like I'm cash out, eat a pop of those. Flowing on turtle Galapagos, running and grab the door.
Galapagos! I love when rappers use random ass shit in songs. Galapagos? Why not?
I really enjoyed the shout out to Los Angeles' Fairfax Shopping District.
Yes! Did you know that that's where, like, a lot of young rappers hang out?
Are they Orthodox Jews?
No, they've completely taken over
that neighborhood. Or young screenwriters.
Young screenwriters. They're all gone. They've all left.
There's that weird shoe store that is constantly has,
oh, yeah,
like...
The Hundreds.
Yes, like upscale hip-hop young men... waiting for shoes.
Kids
or hats.
Hang out in front of there like it's a pub.
Yeah,
it's so strange. That's not a big street to be hanging out. So it's also a major thoroughfare, so I would appreciate it if you'd reduce.
I'm just excited about any music that contributes to the financial base of the city of West Hollywood.
You're welcome.
Margaret, what's your jam?
Well, mine is related to Nina Simone. She's having a real moment. This is a totally separate album from the documentary called Nina Revisited, a tribute to Nina Simone. And it's a bunch of different musicians covering some of her most famous songs, which were covers in the first place. That was one thing that Nina Simone was so gifted at, was really lending her interpretation to various songs. So there's Mary J. Blige, there's Lauryn Hill, there's Common, a bunch of different people on this record. But I want to play the Lauryn Hill version of Feeling Good, because I think that her voice has a real parallel to Nina Simone's, where it has this like smoky, strong quality to it that's really beautiful.
Slightly mentally ill?
Slightly mentally ill or a lot mentally ill. The record will show.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting all by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. Woo. And I'm feeling good.
Isn't it great? I mean, I could listen to her just do the acapella version. I mean, she just
kills
it.
That's so good. Oof. Yeah. And I never thought about it before, but she does have that sort of like intelligent graveliness to what she's doing.
I mean, that's
definitely with age, Lauryn Hill's gotten more of it.
And just hard living.
Hard living, indeed.
Does anyone have a strongly pro or anti Zoe Saldana as Lauryn Hill stands?
I'm going to keep an open mind. You mean Nina Simone? Yeah, I'm going to keep an open mind about
sorry.
It. Yeah, I know the controversy has been that she's a much more light-skinned black woman, in part. That's the controversy. And that was a big deal for Nina Simone. But I you know, I still just want to see how she does. But what do you guys think?
I just think there's this way that Hollywood makes the polite choice to, was it Marvel or DC characters who were people of color as white people because it's easy. And, you know, recasting like non-traditionally looking people in movies with sort of hot people in a fat suit or hot people with a fake nose. And it just kind of gets on my nerves that like a lot of people are told that there is no space for them in entertainment. Mm-hmm. And then when there is clear space for them in entertainment, we ask somebody who is like, honestly, in the second of the Star Trek reboots, that we cast Khan as Benedict Cumberbatch made me want to stab a person. Winner. Strong feelings?
You know, I'm so used to it now. I don't really care either way. I would prefer they'd pick someone who resembled her, but it's also like, then you go, well,
then you get into Cusack, that trap of, you know.
Cusack didn't look like Brian Wilson.
Right.
So,
yeah.
You know, like, I don't know.
It's hard. It's hard, and Zoe Saldana is the best. But, like, one of the things about Nina Simone is that she wasn't an adorable little supreme. Yeah. She was somebody who played by her own rules.
If they would have honored that part of her legacy, it would have been nice. It would have been nice to have a woman of darker skin tone to play her. But if all they could do was get the best black girl in the room, and that was the one, and she's in Star Wars, you know.
Well, I mean, she's the black woman who can kind of open a movie right now, and we have to accept that. All right, you guys.
We'll have to accept that on that note.
All right. So I should be making the final selection for my summer jam this week, but clearly I was messed up last week and did not give my fellow panelists the opportunity to listen to the finalists. So this week, there's only 1 week left in summer jam search. We've got it down to a group of finalists, but then out of nowhere, one of the big players in the summer jam business, she showed up and she came to play. Mm-hmm. Colin, can we hear some Cool for the Summer by Demi Lovato?
Oh, I love Demi Lovato. I can keep a secret, kid. You have a mind on your body and your body on my mind. Got a taste for the cherry. I just need to take the bite. Don't tell your mother. Kiss one another. Die for each other. We're cool for the summer.
Do you guys know what this song is about?
It's about eating out.
Yes, it like whoa. No, it
we are
it is
two for two this month on eating out in songs. The jam. Two for
it
two.
Is. Ooh, it is.
Winter's little dance right now that you guys can't see, but it involves shoulders and hand movements.
Oral sex is making a comeback, y'all.
Did it ever go away?
No, for some people it did.
It's about a lesbian relationship. It is not about, oh, I kissed a girl, I flirted with a girl. It is, hey, guys, so I'm fucking a girl for this summer. You know, it's cool.
Yes.
Like, after a couple of songs that were pretty amazing but just had, like, I don't know if it's OMI or OMI, but Cheerleader is like such a fun, good song, but it's just so a woman's place is to support me. We've had the conversation about Shut Up and Dance, that having something decent that also came from a place of like, you know, a construction of sex that wasn't the most hack.
But who would have guessed that a Summer Dyke would come out on top in your world?
This is not on top. We're not at all saying on top.
There's still a weak lift. Summer Dyke, your bitch. She made you your bitch.
Anything can happen.
Yeah. Don't go U-hauling on us.
You guys, you have been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with the amazing talents of Winner Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Oliver Lang. Oliver Lang?
Oliver Lang.
I just whitewashed Oliver.
He is our Eugene Landy.
My God.
And Oliver Wang. Our theme music is Party Booby Trap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to Ben Weir's Goldenrod Lullaby. Low Body? Glenda Lee M., who I think is my friend Glinda, Pooh Eater, and Molly Laura 1 for the 5-star reviews
Molly
on
Lorraine.
iTunes. Oh, sorry.
Pooh Eater liked us. I feel so honored.
Thank you, Pooh Eater.
If you haven't already, please review us. We'd appreciate it. Get in touch with us on Twitter at Pop Rocket. Join in our Facebook group. You guys have been so active recently. It's super fun. And your like all of your summer jam suggestions have been really, really great. This week, tell us what was the first piece of media, book, CD, or movie you owned, but you tried to hide from your parents. This much discussion of porn, that's what you're not going to get from the other pop culture roundtable podcasts. Mm-hmm. Slate is not asking you to list your first Brandy magazine. Yep. We post show notes every week at MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the always calm and cool Colin Anderson.
Yay, Colin!
Yay.
Woo! Woo!
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.